Chapter 38. Full half a year had come and gone, and Mr. Crisparkle sat in the waiting room in the London chief offices of the Haven of Philanthropy, until he could have audience of Mr. Honeythunder. In his college days of athletic exercises, Mr. Crisparkle had known professors of the noble art of fisticuffs, and had attended two or three of their gloved gatherings. He had now an opportunity of observing that as to the phrenological formation of the backs of their heads, the professing philanthropists were uncommonly like the pugilists. In the development of all those organs which constitute, or attend, a propensity to pitch into your fellow creatures, the philanthropists were remarkably favored. There were several professors passing in and out, with exactly the aggressive air upon them of being ready for a turn up with any novice who might happen to be on hand, that Mr. Crisparkle well remembered in the circles of the fancy. Preparations were in progress for a moral little mill somewhere on the rural circuit, and other professors were backing this or that heavyweight as good for such or such speech-making hits, so very much after the manner of the sporting publicans, that the intended resolutions might have been rounds. An official manager of these displays much celebrated for his platform tactics, Mr. Crisparkle recognized, in a suit of black, the counterpart of a deceased benefactor of his species, an eminent public character, once known to fame as Frosty-Faced Fogo, who in days of yore superintended the formation of the magic circle with the ropes and stakes. There were only three conditions of resemblance wanting between these professors and those. Firstly, the philanthropists were in very bad training. Much too fleshy, and presenting, both in face and figure, a superabundance of what is known to pugilistic experts as suet pudding. Secondly, the philanthropists had not the good temper of the pugilists, and used worse language. Thirdly, their fighting code stood in great need of revision, as empowering them, not only to bore their man to the ropes, but to bore him to the confines of distraction, also to hit him when he was down, hit him anywhere and anyhow, kick him, stamp upon him, gouge him, and maul him behind his back without mercy. In these last particulars the professors of the noble art were much nobler than the professors of philanthropy. Mr. Crisparkle was so completely lost in musing on these similarities and dissimilarities, at the same time watching the crowd which came and went by, always, as it seemed, on errands of antagonistically snatching something from somebody, and never giving anything to anybody, that his name was called, before he heard it. On his at length responding, he was shown by a miserably shabby and underpaid stipendiary philanthropist who could hardly have done worse, if he had taken service with a declared enemy of the human race, to Mr. Honeythunder's room. "Sir," apostrophe said Mr. Honeythunder, in his tremendous voice, like a schoolmaster issuing orders to a boy, of whom he had a bad opinion, "sit down." Apostrophe, Mr. Crisparkle seated himself. Mr. Honeythunder, having signed the remaining few score of a few thousand circulars, calling upon a corresponding number of families without means to come forward, stump up instantly, and be philanthropists, or go to the devil, another shabby stipendiary philanthropist, highly disinterested, if in earnest, gathered these into a basket and walked off with them. "Now, Mr. Crisparkle," apostrophe said Mr. Honeythunder, turning his chair half round towards him when they were alone, and squaring his arms with his hands on his knees, and his brows knitted, as if he added, "I am going to make short work of you. Now, Mr. Crisparkle, we entertain different views, you and I, sir, of the sanctity of human life. Apostrophe, do we?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, returned the minor canon. "We do, sir." Apostrophe, apostrophe, might I ask you, apostrophe, said the minor canon. "What are your views on that subject?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "that human life is a thing to be held sacred, sir." Apostrophe, might I ask you, apostrophe, pursued the minor canon as before. "What do you suppose to be my views on that subject?" ...... by George, sir. ... returned the philanthropist, squaring his arms still more, as he frowned on Mr. Crisparkle. They are best known to yourself. ... readily admitted. But you began by saying that we took different views, you know. Therefore, you could not say, so you must have set up some views as mine. Pray, what views have you set up as mine? ... Here is a man and a young man, ... said Mr. Honeythunder, as if that made the matter infinitely worse, and he could have easily borne the loss of an old one, swept off the face of the earth by a deed of violence. What do you call that? ... murder, ... said the minor canon. What do you call the doer of that deed, sir? ... murderer, ... said the minor canon. I am glad to hear you admit so much, sir, ... retorted Mr. Honeythunder, in his most offensive manner, and I candidly tell you that I didn't expect it. ... Here he lowered heavily at Mr. Crisparkle again. Be so good as to explain what you mean by those very unjustifiable expressions. ... I don't sit here, sir, ... returned the philanthropist, raising his voice to a roar, to be Brobiton. ... As the only other person present, no one can possibly know that better than I do, ... returned the minor canon very quietly. But I interrupt your explanation. ... Murder. ... proceeded Mr. Honeythunder, in a kind of boisterous reverie, with his platform folding of his arms, and his platform nod of abhorrent reflection after each short sentiment of a word. Bloodshed. Abel. Cain. I hold no terms with Cain. I repudiate with a shudder the red hand, when it is offered me. ... Instead of instantly leaping into his chair and cheering himself hoarse, as the brotherhood in public meeting assembled would infallibly have done on this cue, Mr. Crisparkle merely reversed the quiet crossing of his legs, and said mildly, "Don't let me interrupt your explanation when you begin it." ... The commandments say, no murder. No murder, sir. ... proceeded Mr. Honeythunder, platformally pausing as if he took Mr. Crisparkle to task for having distinctly asserted that they said, "You may do a little murder, and then leave off." And they also say, "You shall bear no false witness," ... observed Mr. Crisparkle. "Enough." ... bellowed Mr. Honeythunder, with a solemnity and severity that would have brought the house down at a meeting, no. My late wards being now of age, and I being released from a trust which I cannot contemplate without a thrill of horror, there are the accounts which you have undertaken to accept on their behalf, and there is a statement of the balance which you have undertaken to receive, and which you cannot receive too soon. And let me tell you, sir, I wish that, as a man and a minor canon, you were better employed, ... with a nod. Better employed, ... with another nod. Better employed, ... with another, and the three nods added up. Mr. Crisparkle rose, a little heated in the face, but with perfect command of himself. ... Mr. Honeythunder, ... he said, taking up the papers referred to. My being better or worse employed than I am at present is a matter of taste and opinion. You might think me better employed in enrolling myself a member of your society. ... Indeed, sir. ... retorted Mr. Honeythunder, shaking his head in a threatening manner. It would have been better for you, if you had done that long ago. ... I think otherwise. ... said Mr. Honeythunder, shaking his head again, I might think one of your profession better employed in devoting himself to the discovery and punishment of guilt than in leaving that duty to be undertaken by a layman. ... I may regard my profession from a point of view which teaches me that its first duty is towards those who are in necessity and tribulation, who are desolate and oppressed, ... said Mr. Crisparkle. However, as I have quite clearly satisfied myself that it is no part of my profession to make professions, I say no more of that. But I owe it to Mr. Neville, and to Mr. Neville's sister, and in a much lower degree to myself, to say to you that I know I was in the full possession and understanding of Mr. Neville's mind and heart at the time of this occurrence, and that, without in the least coloring or concealing what was to be deplored in him and required to be corrected, I feel certain that his tale is true. Feeling that certainty, I befriend him. As long as that certainty shall last, I will befriend him. And if any consideration could shake me in this resolve, I should be so ashamed of myself for my meanness, that no man's good opinion, no, nor no woman so gained, could compensate me for the loss of my own. Apostrophe, good fellow. Manly fellow. And he was so modest too. There was no more self-assertion in the minor canon than in the schoolboy who had stood in the breezy playing fields keeping a wicket. He was simply and staunchly true to his duty alike in the large case and in the small. So all true souls ever are. So every true soul ever was, ever is, and ever will be. There is nothing little to the really great in spirit. Then who do you make out did the deed? Apostrophe, apostrophe, asked Mr. Honeythunder, turning on him abruptly. Heaven forbid, apostrophe, said Mr. Crisparkle, that in my desire to clear one man I should lightly criminate another. I accuse no one, apostrophe, pshaw. Apostrophe, apostrophe, ejaculated Mr. Honeythunder with great disgust, for this was by no means the principle on which the philanthropic brotherhood usually proceeded. And, sir, you are not a disinterested witness, we must bear in mind. Apostrophe, how am I an interested one? Apostrophe, apostrophe, inquired Mr. Crisparkle, smiling innocently, at a loss to imagine. There was a certain stipend, sir, paid to you for your pupil, which may have warped your judgment a bit, apostrophe, said Mr. Honeythunder, coarsely. Perhaps I expect to retain it still? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Crisparkle returned, enlightened. Do you mean that too? Apostrophe, apostrophe, well, sir, apostrophe, returned the professional philanthropist, getting up and thrusting his hands down into his trousers pockets, I don't go about measuring people for caps. If people find I have any about me that fit 'em, they can put 'em on and wear 'em, if they like. That's their lookout. Not mine. Apostrophe, Mr. Crisparkle eyed him with a just indignation, and took him to task thus. Apostrophe, Mr. Honeythunder, I hoped when I came in here that I might be under no necessity of commenting on the introduction of platform manners or platform maneuvers among the decent forbearances of private life. But you have given me such a specimen of both that I should be a fit subject for both if I remain silent respecting them. They are detestable. Apostrophe, they don't suit you, I dare say, sir. Apostrophe, they are, apostrophe, repeated Mr. Crisparkle, without noticing the interruption, detestable. They violate equally the justice that should belong to Christians, and the restraints that should belong to gentlemen. You assume a great crime to have been committed by one whom I, acquainted with the attendant circumstances, and having numerous reasons on my side, devoutly believe to be innocent of it. Because I differ from you on that vital point, what is your platform resource? Instantly to turn upon me, charging that I have no sense of the enormity of the crime itself, but am its aider and abettor. So, another time taking me as representing your opponent in other cases you set up a platform credulity, a moved and seconded and carried unanimously profession of faith in some ridiculous delusion or mischievous imposition. I decline to believe it, and you fall back upon your platform resource of proclaiming that I believe nothing, that because I will not bow down to a false god of your making, I deny the true God. Another time you make the platform discovery that war is a calamity, and you propose to abolish it by a string of twisted resolutions tossed into the air like the tail of a kite. I do not admit the discovery to be yours in the least, and I have not a grain of faith in your remedy. Again, your platform resource of representing me as reveling in the horrors of a battlefield like a fiend incarnate. Another time, in another of your undiscriminating platform rushes, you would punish the sober for the drunken. I claim consideration for the comfort, convenience, and refreshment of the sober, and you presently make platform proclamation that I have a depraved desire to turn heaven's creatures into swine and wild beasts. In all such cases, your movers, and your seconders, and your supporters, your regular professors of all degrees, run amok like so many mad Malays, habitually attributing the lowest and basest motives with the utmost recklessness.
Let me call your attention to a recent instance in yourself for which you should blush,
and quoting figures which you know to be as willfully one-sided as a statement of any complicated account, that should be all creditor side and no debtor, or all debtor side and no creditor. Therefore it is, Mr. Honey Thunder, that I consider the platform a sufficiently bad example and a sufficiently bad school, even in public life. But hold that, carried into private life, it becomes an unendurable nuisance. Apostrophe, these are strong words, sir. Apostrophe, apostrophe, exclaimed the philanthropist. I hope so, apostrophe, said Mr. Crisparkle. Good morning. Apostrophe, he walked out of the haven at a great rate, but soon fell into his regular brisk pace, and soon had a smile upon his face as he went along, wondering what the China shepherdess would have said if she had seen him pounding Mr. Honey Thunder in the late little lively affair. For Mr. Crisparkle had just enough of harmless vanity to hope that he had hit hard, and to glow with the belief that he had trimmed the philanthropic jacket pretty handsomely. He took himself to Staple Inn, but not to P.J. T. and Mr. Grugis. Full many a creaking stair he climbed, before he reached some attic rooms in a corner, turned the latch of their unbolted door, and stood beside the table of Neville Landless. An air of retreat and solitude hung about the rooms, and about their inhabitant. He was much worn, and so were they. Their sloping ceilings, cumbrous rusty locks and grates, and heavy wooden bins and beams, slowly moldering withal, had a prisonous look, and he had the haggard face of a prisoner. Yet the sunlight shone in at the ugly garret window, which had a penthouse to itself thrust out among the tiles, and on the cracked and smoke-blackened parapet beyond, some of the deluded sparrows of the place rheumatically hopped, like little feathered cripples who had left their crutches in their nests, and there was a play of living leaves at hand that Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.